This is Kate Moorhead Carroll in the podcast Find It. Today I have with me a member of St. John's Cathedral who has become a good friend and colleague, John Caulfield, who spent his life in the Foreign Service and has had a lot of interaction with this Venezuelan president who has now been taken by us. So, John, give us a little bit of a background on your career, first of all, and how you encountered Maduro.
Well, I'm a career Foreign Service officer, and in 2002, I finished my tour of duty in Lima, where I was, for a substantial period of time, the chargé d'affaires. I was the number two in the embassy, and when you don't have the ambassador, the number two steps up to become in charge, or using the French term, chargé d'affaires. So following that assignment, I went to London. I was the consul general, and I had a lovely assignment of 3 years, and it was coming time to leave, and the department asked if I would go to Caracas, Venezuela. And they said, well, you know, President Chavez is threatening to expel our ambassador. He's done that several times. And we think that you would be a good person to go because you already had extensive experience of being the number two and then stepping up to run the embassy in the absence of the ambassador. I was assigned to Caracas, and the department was prophetic because the ambassador was leaving. Patrick Duddy was the ambassador because his wife was having an operation in the U.S. And so he left on a Friday and I got there on a Monday.
Wow.
And he was going to be away for a week or so. And on the Thursday of that week, President Chavez expelled him, even though he hadn't done anything. But the president of Bolivia, Evo Morales, had expelled the U.S. ambassador in Bolivia. And in solidarity, President Chavez decided he was going to expel the U.S. ambassador as well. So, as I said, on my first week on the job, Comandante Chavez gave me a battlefield promotion, and I wound up being in charge of the embassy for most of the next 3 years.
Okay.
And so at that time, the foreign minister was Maduro. He was the foreign minister.
Okay.
And so the whole time I was there, he was the foreign minister, and I would deal with him or with his deputy when they were calling me, often to complain about things. Mm-hmm. But I was used to dealing with him. Maduro was interesting people. Most of the leadership group around Chavez were former military officers who had been in the military academy, who joined with him to attempt a military coup in Venezuela, and which was unsuccessful. And later on, he went to prison, and after he got out of prison, he became a politician. And his former colleagues in arms joined with him, supported him in his presidential campaign. It was a dark time for Venezuela. They were going through an economic crisis. The price of oil had dropped precipitously, and the government was unable to meet people's demands. And so this was the new phase. This was when he ran for office. It was 1998. Just to give you an example, the price of oil had dropped at one point to its lowest in memory, to about $10 a barrel. And Chavez was successful in that election, and he was the new face. At one point, the opposition candidate was a former Miss Venezuela, so none of the traditional politicians were in the mix. And he won that election, and miraculously, within 2 years, the price of oil had hit $140 a barrel. And so they were living large. They had more money than even Venezuela ever dreamed about. And President Chavez used it to influence the region and aspire to a leadership role. He was he was an admirer of Fidel Castro. Oh. He was a nationalist, and he felt that Venezuela had been held back, and the problems they had were either due to traditional, what he would call traditional Venezuelan politicians, or the United States.
I see.
And so he was elected. Of course, as president in a constitutional system, your powers were limited. But he immediately called upon the public to support a constitutional convention which would write a new constitution, saying, you know, I need to change things. I don't have enough power to do it. And therefore, we need to change this constitution so I'm able to do what needs to be done. The constitution was approved, and then, of course, he was much more powerful essentially developed into pretty much a one-man rule system. Now, Maduro, who he was not a former military leader, he was kind of your traditional leftist politician. He was a bus driver, and he joined the bus drivers union. He became the leader of the bus drivers union. He went to Cuba. He received some instruction in, you know, labor activism in Cuba. And then after the failed coup attempt by Chavez the first time, Maduro approached him and said, "I believe in what you're trying to do." And supported him, and after Chavez got out of jail and later ran for office, Maduro was one of his close supporters. As a matter of fact, Chavez used to joke about Maduro. He said, "You know, on the campaign, every time we were trying to get someplace and there's traffic, Maduro knew the route to go." He said, "Well, you go around here, he's a bus driver, he knew how to get all around town." and so he liked Maduro. Maduro was with him from the beginning. It's not clear why Chavez appointed Maduro to be foreign minister of all the things he could have done. Maduro did not have a strong educational background. He was very adept at kind of reading the room, knowing, you know, power relationships, and he was very close to the Cubans ideologically, whereas Chavez was more out of his own sense of nationalism. He admired Fidel for standing up to the United States. And
these are two powerful personalities working together. What was that dynamic like?
Well, I mean, Chavez was the star, and you know, Maduro was the acolyte. That was kind of the relationship, and he was very good at it. He was, if Chavez said something on a speech one night, the next day about the United States, the next day Maduro would be calling me in to, you know, follow up on whatever Chavez had to say or whatever the complaint he had to make.
So he was pretty bright.
He was bright in the sense, he was clever.
Clever.
In terms of his sort of intellectual capacity, perhaps not as much, but he obviously didn't have the preparation of an education.
Perhaps an EQ, an intuition, perhaps?
Yeah, he had a good... He certainly understood Chavez. Uh-huh. And he understood that the hold that Chavez held over ordinary people in Venezuela. Chavez was a very gifted orator. Mm. He was a charismatic personality. Mm-hmm. He could be nasty. He could be funny. Mm. He would have this show every weekend, every Sunday, where he would go on television for hours. And he would give speeches, he would tell jokes, he would invite celebrities, beauty queens, whatever, singers and dancers. And it was like a variety show, which would go all afternoon. But Chavez was able to speak a language that ordinary Venezuelans understood. Mm-hmm. He grew up as a lower middle class person like many in lower middle classes, looked to the military as an opportunity to move ahead. And he went much further than anyone would have imagined. And I think ordinary Venezuelans saw him as, he's a person just like me.
Wow.
Even when I disagree with him, I still like him.
Yeah.
He understands us. Mm-hmm. He cares
they
about us.
They felt connected to him.
And there was so much money at that time that even though there was tremendous corruption, there was a lot to go around.
Yeah.
And he was able to reward his supporters. Improving medical care, improving health care, which was not bad. Venezuela was one of the most advanced Latin American countries, but it had fallen on hard times briefly when the oil prices had collapsed. And sort of as the money came back in, he was able to restore these services, and he was very popular. After a while, you know, problems began to develop, and his arbitrary rule rubbed against people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Venezuelans realized that this guy is pretty volatile and unpredictable. Many were uncomfortable with his embrace of communism, mm-hmm. Although the private sector continued to operate in Venezuela, but as long as they were loyal. And the other thing that Chavez ignored was the fact that because he put a value on loyalty above all else, criminal elements in Venezuela, particularly gangs in the cities, who sold drugs and had extortion rackets and things like that, sort of made an unwritten deal that we will guarantee the support of these poor neighborhoods to Chavez, and you leave us alone to conduct our business activities. Again, one of the worst was the sale of drugs.
Was Maduro aware of all that?
Yes, of course he was. But the issue, the important thing was that the regime survived. And now Chavez, at the end of my tour there, became very ill. He was diagnosed with cancer. He never said what kind. He was diagnosed in Cuba. Maduro tended to travel with him to Cuba. And then Chavez anointed Maduro as his successor, if anything happened to him.
Yep. So, John, tell me about how the transfer of power occurred from Chavez to Maduro.
Well, after Chavez was diagnosed with cancer, he was diagnosed in Cuba and was attended by Cuban physicians. And as the condition worsened, Chavez said that Maduro would be his successor, even though he was the foreign minister. He wasn't in a natural line of succession. And I think he did this because Chavez was very under the influence of Fidel Castro and the Cubans. He was getting all of his medical care from them. Maduro accompanied him throughout this medical care, along with family members. And Maduro was perceived by the Cubans as a reliable successor because he was a lifelong communist or leftist socialist. He was a labor activist. He received education in labor activism in Cuba. And I think they believed that he was their best prospect for the future. They were a little more suspicious, I think, about some of the nationalists, the military officers who might not see Cuba and Venezuela's interests to be identical. And the Cubans had, by this point, were heavily dependent on Venezuelan resources. Venezuela not only provided all the oil to Cuba, but enough surplus that the Cubans could refine it and then sell fuel as an additional source of income. And the Cubans were paid very well for all their medical technicians, for their engineers, for their teachers, for their security services that they sent in vast numbers to Cuba, to Venezuela. And so Cuba had a lot at stake with Venezuela and with the succession of Chavez, and Maduro was their guy. Mm. And as expected, when Chavez passed away, Maduro became the acting president. Then he ran for election and he was elected as president in a very quick election. But things had begun to change in Venezuela. The economy was not doing well. The years of corruption had seriously undermined the infrastructure of Venezuela, because every time there was a big ticket item for infrastructure, much of the money was stolen. The work didn't get done. This particularly happened in the oil industry, where the infrastructure of the industry continued to decline, which caused a decrease in production. At the same time, oil prices had begun to drop. And so the government had difficulty providing the funding for social services that it had traditionally provided. And there was more discontent. And as this continued in future, generally, by using government resources liberally, they were able to buy elections. But now they realized they could no longer buy the elections, and that the first thing that happened was that they lost the legislative elections, where the Congress went from two-thirds Chavista to two-thirds opposition. And of course, what they did then is they created a new constitutional convention, which took
when
over
you
the
say
power
they,
of Congress. The Chavistas, Maduro,
oh, Maduro
and his
so
team. Yeah, because they had, you know, they replaced all the judiciary.
I see.
So essentially they could do whatever they wanted. They wanted to go through the formality of elections when they felt they could win. But then when they realized after the congressional elections that they weren't going to win elections anymore, they were troubled and they created new mechanisms. Number one, to undermine the power of Congress. And then secondly, to make sure that in all future elections, they would control the levers of, you know, the National Electoral Council, the judiciary, so that they could get their way no matter what the results were. And of course, this came to a head in 2024 when they had presidential elections and Maduro overwhelmingly lost. First of all, they disqualified the major opposition candidate, a lady named Maria Corina Machado. And then when they nominated a stand-in for her, they felt, oh, this guy doesn't have a chance.
Well,
he won two-thirds of the vote. You know, people were just fed up. And
what did Maduro do with that?
Well, they faked the results.
Oh,
you know, they
claimed
they shut down all of the polling stations, shut down the Electoral Council, which was totally dominated by his supporters. And they just came out and said, well, the results is another overwhelming victory for President Maduro. But, you know, as part of the polling process, each polling station prints out a report of the votes, and they give it to the representatives of the parties who are there. So the opposition party, when they got these reports before the final results, you know, they hid them and they saved all of them for around the country. So after Maduro proclaimed the election, they were able to say, well, here, we have the original poll results of all these polls, and they show to the contrary, we won the election. Of course, Maduro wasn't hearing any of it. Now, people were upset, and so they protested. And, you know, they became more vocal in the opposition, and as a result, the government began to crack down. They arrested people. Not only did they arrest them, they would torture people. Routinely, they would torture people. Not only to extract information, but to make the punishment worse. And they arrested a number of opposition politicians, or they would arrest people close to them who they could abuse and cause pain to the more prominent official without the, you know, the onus of, of imprisoning somebody who was more prominent.
So a couple of questions. Did you see that kind of paranoid, power-hungry person when you interacted with Maduro?
Well, no, Maduro was, I think Maduro was probably a person content to be in the upper echelons in the government. But with the death of Chavez, that changed things. And
when he got a taste of being the number one,
and he was not the most,
change.
He was far from being the most powerful politician. There were many others who were much more powerful and much more influential with the security services. But again, Maduro was, in one sense, he was neutral in that if you had picked another powerful figure, his powerful rivals might have clashed. And he was a person who, the perception was, I might not be president, but I can continue my corruption, I can continue my illegal activities. And among those activities was drug trafficking. And so there was considerable drug trafficking from Venezuela to outside the country. Venezuela was not a producer of drugs. The cocaine was produced in Colombia, and that was the primary drug that was exported from Venezuela. And so it would be produced in Colombia. Initially, it was the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, the FARC, the guerrilla, leftist guerrilla group that fought the Venezuelan government and supported itself through drug trafficking. And after the Colombian government had a peace treaty with the FARC and demilitarization, there was a significant group of the FARC that operated in Venezuela with the complacency of the Venezuelan government. And that group broke off and said, no, we're not going to do it. And they basically had become a criminal organization. Mm-hmm. They were like any other narcotics cartel. They were in it for the money. But they had their network within Venezuela. And over the years, even though Chavez was very tolerant of the FARC and their drug activities, those Venezuelan officials who were in the region of the drug trafficking began to say, hey, well, we want our share of this. You know, so if it was the general who controlled the airport that drugs were flying out of, well, he wanted his cut. Or if it was the port captain who controlled the port activities, or it was the customs director who, you know, could examine cargo, all these people demanded their cut. And because many of these were general officers, the name came the Cartel of the Soles, because the Venezuelan military officers, instead of wearing stars on their epaulets, they wore suns, you know, and that's, and so the more sons you had, the higher the rank you were, and so this they began to call it the Cartel de los Soles.
So, why did Trump want to remove Maduro? What is it because of the drugs? What's your thoughts?
Well,
about
over
all that?
Over the years, this, and particularly as oil revenues declined, the drug revenues became much more important, and so people who were the traditional narcotics gangs were exporting, but other people began to think, well, you know, I should make some money on this. Among them were the two nephews of the Venezuelan First Lady, who organized to export, you know, a large quantity of cocaine to the United States. They made contacts. Unfortunately for them, they were detected by the DEA through an undercover operation. They arranged to make the drug sale, and when they did, they were arrested and they were brought to the United States. This was in, I think, the Dominican Republic. And so,
what year was this about? What year was that?
This was, I'm just trying to think, this was probably about 2020, maybe just before the pandemic. Okay. And it was during the Biden administration.
Okay.
And so they were arrested, they were in jail in the United States. But throughout the government, the illegal activities began to replace some of the income from petroleum. Among other things was gold. They had vast resources of gold in Venezuela. They were unexplored. They're out in the jungles. And the government, there were like these informal miners that would go out and they would sort of, you know, pan the streams, like, you know, the 49ers in California. And so the military took control of that. The miners would work, but they had to sell the gold to the military, and the military would then take their cut, the government would take its cut, and the miners would get, you know, a small amount. And so these gold revenues became quite significant for Venezuela and helped to deal with the lack of the oil revenues. But all of this was part of a corrupt system.
Right.
It involved money laundering, it involved theft of property, and also operating in Venezuela were other organizations that need to have financial transactions with no questions asked. And these were terrorist organizations. They were based out of the Middle East, Hamas in particular. Not so much that they were carrying on terrorist activities, but financing was going on because of this very permissive financial environment. You know, you could launder dollars for gold, sell the gold for, you know, arms, and so you were able to. And so the indictment of Maduro was that basically he was presiding over this type of operation, which allowed a lot of violations of U.S. laws, not only for the trafficking of drugs, but money laundering and related crimes. And he was indicted in 2000. During the previous Trump administration, and this indictment was dormant because obviously he was president of Venezuela.
Sure.
I'm not sure what led Trump to decide after, you know,
it now. Yeah.
Acting again, you know, they of course were trying to interdict the drug boats, and most of these drugs, however, were not going to the U.S. They were going to Europe. They were going to intermediate delivery points in the on the Caribbean islands and then going over to Europe, which consumes probably more cocaine than the United States does today. But nevertheless, there was drug trafficking going on. That's true. He attacked the boats. it is true that, you know, to operate as a drug trafficker in Venezuela, you had to pay off. You had to pay off officials. Mm-hmm. You had to pay off the police, the army, the navy, you know, anyone who might have some kind of a tentacle into that operation. And again, this was all with the complacency and perhaps the design of Maduro. This is what the indictment says. This is what will have to be proven in a court of law. The other issue for the United States was that the president had demanded that we get rid of people who are undocumented migrants. And over 1 million of these were Venezuelans. Mm-hmm. And they were people who fled the government. And the idea is, well, we can't get rid of these people until they can go back. Go. How can we justify deporting them? Right. You know, we can't deport a million people to Africa, you know, because they can't go to Venezuela. And so the system has to change in Venezuela in order for us to find a place to return these people. So that was another issue. Mm. Venezuela's support for Cuba was an irritant to the United States, although had never, certainly not in his first administration, caused President Trump to feel that that was a reason we had to.
Yeah, because there are many countries in South America that have certainly have a lot of immigrants with us. And then there are also many countries that do a lot of drug trafficking. Why Maduro? What was
the idea is that Maduro was complicit with this. There are other countries that, you know, the United States has drug trafficking.
Sure.
Mexico. But, I mean, officials are trying to stop that. It is very difficult.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're kind of on the side of the good guys trying to stop it. Of course, there's corruption and there's the violence of the cartels and the intimidation of people. If, you know, the what they would say, the plomo or plata, you know, you can take our money, the plata, the silver, or you can take our lead, our bullets. You know, that's your choice.
Oh,
go along or die. You know, and so there are many people in the middle, you know, not powerful people who don't really have much of a choice.
So from a character perspective, would you say that Maduro, would you see this as a, it sounds like he was never an innocent man, but would you say that the corruption of being number one made him worse in character over the years?
Well, of course, the power corrupts, you know?
Yeah. So the guy that you interacted with was not as corrupt as the guy a decade later.
No, I would say he was corrupt and he may have had inclinations, but he didn't have the power himself. Once he became president, he would do whatever it took.
Yeah.
If people want to vote for me, it's fine. But if they don't, you know,
I'm keeping it anyway.
I'm keeping this power anyway, and I'll do whatever I have to stay in power. And of course, he was encouraged in this by others who benefited from that situation.
And John, what about now we've removed him, but how does that solve the problem since his administration is still in power?
That is the question. And I don't think they thought this through.
Okay.
I honestly don't think is what happens the day after. And we're right there now. We're saying, well, this new government, having been intimidated by taking out Maduro, will do what we want. I haven't seen that they're willing to accept the tutelage of the United States. And Trump has not helped himself by making such a crass demand, well, we want the oil, you know? This is not, we support democracy, we support the, you know, the welfare of the American people. It's, we want the oil. And that's not
going to inspire
a justification
anybody to
that will, you know, I think inspire Venezuelans. Nevertheless, Venezuelans are so fed up with the status quo that, there may be
anything's
a tolerance
yeah.
for some period where, you know, you might transition. So in theory, you could hope that, yes, this government got the message, they're cooperative, they have a transition to a new Democratic government, they reduce corruption, they reinvest in their oil industry, and everything's happy ever after. But the point is, there's still a lot of bad guys in it who have a lot of guns.
Right.
And, you know, there are corrupt members of the military, the security services. There are criminal gangs, the narcotics gangs. There are in all the big cities these gangs which control the cities. They control the local drug business. And all of these people are going to resist a change in the status quo of losing their privileges and losing their income. And so this is the big question.
Yes, yeah.
Without Maduro, or in the previous case without Chavez, how will you deal with these? And I think there was a certain fear that, you know, if you just got rid of Maduro, like getting rid of Saddam Hussein, you know, if you break it, you own it. And what if this place just develops into a failed state with armed gangs and a sort of a, you know, disastrous situation, which of course looks like
it's possible.
You know, yeah. It could get worse. Yes. That's the idea.
Mm-hmm. And what is the impact on the other South American countries, do you think? What are they thinking from all this?
Well, this is a mix. Nobody liked Maduro, really.
Okay.
You know, everyone knew he was corrupt. Even the leftist governments of Latin America knew that Maduro was corrupt. Even a country like Brazil, which, mm-hmm. you know, has a socialist president, was not sympathetic to Maduro. On the other hand, they don't like the U.S. military intervention because
sure.
they can all think, well, this could happen to us.
Right.
And so, you know, I think there's mixed feelings. There's some of the governments who said, good riddance for this guy, mm-hmm. maybe half the countries in South America. And the other half, you know, are unhappy, distressed. You know, the president of Colombia, President Petro, is a former guerrilla himself. He is a leftist. And he attacked Trump strongly even before this. Mm. So, whereas Colombia is not really a leftist country, but again, when you have a democracy and one party fails, the people often pick the other extreme.
I mean,
this happens all the time. And so, you know, they were pretty unhappy in Colombia with the conservative governments.
Yeah.
And this guy, you know, was the opposite of that. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. they elected him. I don't think they're real happy with President Petro, who's on his way out. He can't be reelected. But he's making his last hurrah, and he is doing it by standing up to mm-hmm. President Trump. Mm-hmm. That's where Colombia stands. But half the countries in South America have sort of said, okay, this had to be done. We understood it. We hope that democracy can be restored in Venezuela. And the other half says this is outrageous. Mm-hmm. And because, you know, even though we didn't like Maduro, even though he was corrupt, this is not the way to do it.
Tell me about international law and what Trump did. Is that considered illegal or not?
Well, the thing you have to remember, in international law, there is no court that, you know, in a practical sense, determines whether you have broken the law and can enforce that decision. So it basically is voluntary compliance. But the basic principle is you do not take military action against a country unless you are defending yourself. And in this case, I think President Trump tried to make the case that Venezuela is attacking the U.S. through drug trafficking, supporting drug trafficking. And frankly, we know that at one point Chavez and Maduro felt that, well, if these drugs undermine the U.S. society, it's just as well. We don't like them anyway, and they're causing us problems. So they saw drug trafficking, number one, as a financial opportunity, and number two, as a way to degrade the U.S., its society. And so that would be a reason that Trump would say that we are defending the United States. He's also cited the immigration that Venezuela was expelling people, the refugees were showing up in the United States, and that was another attack against the United States. But the way this developed, we did not invade Venezuela, we did not take over their territory. We sent a relatively small team of people to extract Maduro and his wife, who was also indicted, bring them back to the United States, and they were arraigned on Monday, you know, before court. So, and at the same time, instead of replacing the government or attempting to replace the government of Venezuela, we have indicated that we're going to try to work with that, you know, with them to do things that we want. And we have said that the opposition government or the opposition force, which won the last elections overwhelmingly, we're not going to deal with. So this is ambiguous.
Message.
There's a lot of ambiguity here.
Yeah.
But ultimately, I think what people need to do is countries define their self-interest and what is necessary for them to do according to their own criteria. There is no international enforcement, particularly of a major power, to prevent them from doing it, short of force. And the force is, for example, if Taiwan were invaded by China.
Right.
I mean, what would be the response? It's either you would resist militarily, Taiwan would fight, its allies would fight, maybe the U.S., but it wouldn't be a court of law that determined, you know, whether the right thing for China to do.
So you would think in a way that it would be in our best interest to have the opposition party take control, but is Trump refusing to do that mainly because of the amount of manpower it would take on our part to make that transition?
Well, I think if there were a complete turnover in the government in Venezuela, there are a lot of powerful people who would feel vulnerable. Vulnerable, first of all, because their economic opportunities were reduced.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, they could be prosecuted. They could be put in jail. They could have done to them what they've done to the opposition. So there would have to be an understanding of how the transition or the turnover would occur in ways that did not make people decide we have to fight to the last bullet in order to avoid this because the consequences are too terrible for us. So there has to be a negotiation. Perhaps this allows a negotiation to happen. I mean, only history will tell. I mean, it's interesting that President Trump gave Maduro essentially a golden parachute. And they said, take your money, you can go off someplace, you can live a nice life for the rest of your life. We're not going to prosecute you. You're going to be safe. And he turned that offer down. Whether in the future other leaders who also have blood on their hands will accept a golden parachute or whether it will be offered is not clear.
Interesting. Well, thank you so much, John, for your time.
Okay.
And it's amazing to be talking with someone who's actually face-to-face, really interacted with Maduro and knows these things from mm-hmm. the inside. So you're a great resource and friend. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you for joining me in this podcast. May God bless you and keep you always.